This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The first annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon, and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from One Green World, a nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. Now located in Portland at 6469 Southeast 134th Avenue. For a color catalog, the number is 1-877-353-4028 or online at onegreenworld.com.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go home.
My mistake, everyone. My mistake entirely.
Good morning, Glenn Andreessen here beside you now. Welcome to the Dirt Bag. Jim is to be arriving shortly, we hope. Not here beside me yet. I'll be here until noon. And we've got a full show even planned here. And stay tuned. As Kurt said, we do have tickets to give away for the answer to our garden stumper. And we have three pairs of tickets to give away, so we'll come up with some other ways for you to win those. We've got the plant of the month, parsnips, a very kind of an easy plant to grow, depending on how big they get, harder to harvest. Also, I'll be talking about summer pruning and espalier. This is a good time to think about that and give you my thoughts on that. At 11:30, the garden stumper. And if Jim gets here, we'll also talk about a little bit about Know Thy Pest and some spraying incidents that we've experienced recently. Most prominently, of course, the spraying of the linden trees in Wilsonville. And Jim will be here to talk about a neighbor of his who was spraying willy-nilly kind of his blueberries, not knowing what the pest was, I think, or something like that. So, and as usual, please don't hesitate to call with any questions you may have. 503-231-8187. Any kind of gardening question, we try to help you with that. I'll start off today with parsnips, members of the umbellifera, also related to carrots, and you would prepare the ground about the same way. But unlike carrots, parsnips improve after their flavor improves and the sweetness improves after they've gone through a frost or two or three. In fact, you can leave them in the ground. They're pretty darn hardy. You can sow. I think you could even get a sowing in now if you're so convinced after this plant of the month. Really sow from late March to early June. They do take a while to germinate, 14 to 21 days. Mine have even been longer than that. I've had a little bit older seed than normal. Well, than is recommended. They only last about a year. Mine, I think, are more than a year old, so I sowed them more heavily. And I think I'll maybe sow them again. It is only July 10th, so I think that qualifies as early July. And they're pretty hardy. They need, you know, with the cold weather, they need what, 75 degrees soil temperature for germination. Not going to have any problem getting that these days. It's nice maybe to cover them with a little bit of compost or other type of covering, maybe a row cover or something like that, to shade the soil and conserve moisture, just to make sure they don't dry out during these hot days. And boy, we've got some hot ones coming up apparently there. Soil pH about the same as what we find naturally here or with other vegetables, somewhere in the 6 to 6.8 range. By adding copious amounts of compost through the years, your pH should be just fine there. It's nice maybe to have some deep soil for these parsnips. They can really get long. 1 to 2 feet is possible. The 2 feet, of course, a little bit more rare. But I tell you, I've had parsnips so long and so hard to get out that I couldn't even dig them out. I mean, I'd really have to dig. But, you know, I'd dig down a foot and try to pull them out, and they just broke. They didn't. It was a big parsnip there. But if it's gone through a frost or two, then the flavor is really improved. And you can use them to, you know, stir fry them, roast them, steam them, mash them, bake them, combine them with other potatoes or carrots, soups, all sorts of things can be happen there. Let's see there. In our climate here, we really don't have to take too many precautions for them to for overwintering. They are biennial, so whatever you don't harvest will start to a seed stock. They'll bolt in the early spring, and they get huge. And if you want to save the seed, let one of them go to seed. But boy, if you let too many of them, or if you let too many seeds hit the ground, whew, you're going to be pulling parsnips up all over the place, because they put out, I don't know how many thousand of seeds per one plant. So, one piece of information here that in optimal conditions, maybe 60% of the seeds will germinate. Yeah, we'll see about that. Not many pests and diseases there. The carrot rust fly maggots can be a problem there. I just would recommend for that to plant beneficial insect attracting plants, so the you can take care of the fly and the maggots before they go underground. Otherwise, you know, floating row cover is always recommended, but boy, that's a hassle as far as I'm concerned. So that's parsnips. Don't forget to water them. They, you know, are big plant. They need a lot of water. And that's why I chose for the first musical break here this an old piece from Wilson Pickett. It's called "You Left the Water Running." So don't forget about that for parsnips. Thank you. Wilson Pickett from 1966. That's when Jim was a teenager. Who has just walked in the door here after fighting traffic here, apparently. He'll get his headphones situated and whatnot. 1966, Wilson Pickett from the album Wicked Pickett. Well, welcome, Jim.
It's great to be here, Glenn. Much nicer than in traffic. I think this is the first time that that's happened that I couldn't get here on time.
I know one time I was late because I had a flat tire on my bicycle.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess we get one a year maybe or something like that, right?
That's okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I should say once again, or for the first time, full disclosure, One Green World is an underwriter of the program, and Jim is with One Green World. So I have talked about the plant of the month, parsnips, and we're ready to move into summer pruning.
Great. I actually listened to the show as I was as I was driving in.
So you haven't missed a thing yet.
I listened as fast as I could.
Good. Well, summer pruning is, most people have fruit orchards. If they're new to the business, kind of know that we prune when the tree is dormant or in the wintertime. But that's not the only time that we can prune. And the kind of the rule of thumb for me is how to decide when you're going to prune is that a couple of things. If the tree is the size that you want it, then there should be no question that summer pruning is the time to prune. When you prune in the summer, you don't get nearly the amount of suckering or water shoots that come up after that. And more of the energy will go into fruit production. Whereas if the tree is small or if it's large, then summer is not the time to prune it. If it's a young tree, let it grow bigger and then prune in the winter times to help with the shaping of it, make pruning cuts then, and the tree then will respond by growing more, which is what you want when it's young. Paradoxically, the time to prune when the tree is big is also in the winter time. And because my rule of thumb for summer pruning, here I am going back and forth, but summer pruning, we're not going to take off any branches larger than what you can do with your hand pruners. So if you do have strong hands, then you can prune larger branches by my reasoning here, but that misses the point in that we don't want to be taking off big branches, structural branches at this point. If you have a big tree and you want to get it smaller, although that's very hard to do and to do properly, and it's only a short-term solution, I recommend making it a 3 or more year project. So if you have a big pear tree that you want to get down in size, every winter for the next 3, take off a third of the branches that you may want to take off. In the summer, you're not going to be making any chainsaw cuts, any handsaw cuts, only hand pruners. That's my rule of thumb. Timing, mid-July through mid-August, even though it's before mid-July. Well, we're at mid-July. This is an early year, so have at it. There's lots of sprouts out there. And I've done it as late as end of September, even October. Just in an emergency situation, I wanted to get these small trees pruned and did it, no ill effects. Of course, you never know on what the weather may bring.
I think the biggest thing to think about in terms of timing, tell me if you agree with this, Glenn, is that if you prune too late in the summer and the plant's vigorously growing, it can send out new shoots that can be sort of tender going into winter temperatures. So I think your rule going by mid-August, finish the summer pruning, and then if you did have to prune, like you said, later in September or something, you're not going to encourage, it's going to be too late for those new shoots to start.
Right. Yeah, so that would be an argument for not to prune in June, for example, in the fruit trees. Because then you might get, you're not going to get the benefit of the summer pruning. It will put out new growth that kind of defeats the purpose then.
Right, right. But we actually do it in the nursery. We will prune in June. In fact, we're even doing some pruning right now on young, very young trees to encourage branching, because if you have a whip, for example, a single stem tree that's just growing up and you want it to branch, pruning now or a little bit earlier will encourage the lower buds to grow and you'll get branching, uh-huh. which you otherwise might not get.
Okay.
And you can do the same thing on branches. If you prune back a tip back a branch in fairly early in the summer, then it has time to grow out new growth, which can harden off for the winter.
And for my espalier pears, particularly, I prune 3 or 4 times a summer. Mm-hmm. They're just way too vigorous and yes. are getting in my pathway and whipping me in the face. So off they come, and that doesn't seem to bother them either.
Yeah, they eventually learn that they're supposed to be an espalier and not a tree. So
I guess I'm not disciplining them well enough. <I guess. laughs> Well, so that's kind of our primer there on summer pruning. There's not much more to say. You know, I was going to say, well, most of the cuts that we would be making, or maybe all the cuts that we'd be making, are thinning cuts. Now that is taking it back to a branch or a crotch. But Jim has said, you know, well, maybe a little bit earlier in the summer, you would be making a heading cut like you would on these whips. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
Or even on a branch, if you want to right. encourage more buds or fruiting buds.
Yeah,
on a branch.
Right. So you'll create more side branching, which would then, of course, create more fruit for the
right,
following
okay.
year.
So. All right. So that's, I don't have anything more to say than that. You know, that make sure your pruners are sharp. I use, you know, an anvil type pruner, a bypass pruner rather than an anvil type. An anvil type is kind of blunt. It has its place, that type of pruning, but most of the time, we'd recommend a bypass pruning, more like scissors, so it more cleanly cuts the branch.
And be sure they're sharp, like you said. And it's interesting, since we don't have video to show this process, I'm constantly showing people how I sharpen pruners, which is essentially use a 6-inch file. I just
a metal file.
I put find some support for the pruner, open it up fully, and then prune away from the cutting side. At the angle that is already on your pruner, hopefully that those nice angle, but you prune away from it, then you don't end up with a little edge,
a burr
that will basically cause a bad cut. You want a nice clean cut, and you should be able to run your finger along that sharpened edge and feel no ridge at all, no burr there. So it's and it'll work. It works well.
And I was going to say something, but I forgot now. Okay.
Yeah, and tight pruners need to be tight, and it don't want to be loose.
Oh, the reason that we want a clean cut is so disease and bacteria, or disease mostly, so the wound heals better.
Yes.
That's the main reason for that, and if it doesn't, then it can fester for a while and have a better chance of getting infected.
And since we're talking about pruning, one of my favorite subjects, I would someday want to invent a bumper sticker that says I'd rather be pruning because I love doing it in the wintertime. It gives me lots of upper body movement and stuff. But as a person looks at a branch or a tree or decide where they're going to make a cut, especially if it's back to an existing branch or a leader or a trunk, you see a collar where the branch is grown out of, and you want to leave that collar and cut just at it so that that's where all the new growth is going to come over and heal that cut from. If you go all the way flush to the branch, then you've removed that, and that's really bad, more difficult for the tree to heal that wound.
Right. The tree doesn't make a scab like our human skin does and then grow more skin eventually. The tree just sends growth out over the cut and fills it, mm-hmm. covers it.
Yep.
Which is why we don't necessarily recommend painting the cuts these days. Although yeah. I think there's still some. Did you have some miracle product or something?
Yeah. What's that that baby soap, Dreft?
Oh, yes.
Dreft.
And how did that work?
A 50-50. Well, if you do a Google search on it, you'll see in California, they really found it down there in grapevines. When they were pruning grapevines, they had much less dieback of the vine after cutting, after pruning, when they would take a little brush and do this 50% solution of Dreft on the wound.
So, we might have to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, yeah.
I want it to be peer-reviewed research that we're talking about.
Yeah, apparently it is fairly well accepted now in California. And, you know, we've been doing it on our plants, and I haven't seen any adverse effects. And so I guess that's good because I'm not seeing dieback either.
But you have to do a controlled experiment, though, some on some and some on the other, and then pay attention to both. And
Glenn, when would you like to come out and help me with that?
Well, I'd like to report on it. Yes. I'll write a grant proposal soon. Right?
Any listener out there that would like to help us with that experiment, we'd love to hear from you.
Speaking of listeners, let's go to the phones now. Good morning, Charles. You're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
I've got a two-point question. I have a sour cherry tree. In the last few years, it's been giving me lots of cherries. This year, it is virtually none. And I notice it has conks on the trunk. Are they the cause of this?
What's the is the tree vigorous otherwise? Is it has nice leaf foliage growth and all that? Or is it looking kind of like it's going downhill?
No, it's got lots of leaves on it. And it's actually, it's a little... You know, it spread out a little more this year than last year.
Mm-hmm. And it bloomed well? Did you see flowers?
There were buds on it, and I don't think the wind came at the wrong time to blow them away. There were a few cherries.
Yeah, that's hard to explain. We've had a pretty good crop this year, even enough cherries that the birds get a bunch, and we still get some.
I've seen spotty production around the city. Some were very good, and some I would have thought there would have been more.
So what should I do about these conks? They're like wafers that grow off the side of the trunk.
It's a what that's growing off of it?
They look like wafers. The shape of a wafer, okay?
Boy, that sounds like a fungus.
Scab of some sort.
That's growing on dead wood, it sounds like to me, maybe.
Yeah,
on the trunk and then some of the junctures where the branches come in.
What first thing I would do is to take a pocket knife or something and scrape the bark around that area and see if what's underneath, if it's green or if it sounds like it'd probably be brown and dead. And sample around the tree and see, scrape a little bit and just see what the cambium layer looks like. That's going to give you an idea of the general health of the tree, especially in that area. But that doesn't sound good. Bacterial canker is the most common disease on cherry trunks, you could say cherry trees, which creates a kind of a bronze-colored exudation from the, which is the basically sap that's come out, and then it gets hard, and underneath that area is usually dead. The best way to deal with all prunus in our climate is vigor. And the more vigorous the plant is, the happier it is, the more likely it's going to be able to resist those kinds of infections and diseases.
But this bacterial canker doesn't make wafers that he was describing.
No, like you said, Glenn, that sounds more like something you'd see on really dead wood.
Yeah, saprophytic fungus.
Okay, I'll do that. Hello.
All right.
Hello.
Yeah.
Second part, real quick. I've got a plum tree that for a number of years I did all the things you were supposed to do and I never got any plums. So I talked to an old timer. He said, leave it alone. Don't touch it. Don't do anything to it. And now I'm getting tons of plums. Should I leave it that way?
No, I think you should go back
to doing it right. Yeah. You don't want plums, right? No, I think it sounds great. I'm not sure. I'd be curious to know what you were doing before.
Yeah. Well, you know, some whatever you're supposed to put on. The next thing I know, the leaves are all oily, and then the aphids come and all that stuff. So I don't do anything to it.
Yeah, good.
I leave it alone.
A good lesson.
Okay.
This year was a much better year for plums at our place than the previous 2 years. So there are also some weather factors. We had extremely wet and yucky springs the last two of them.
Wind comes up at the wrong time in the spring, blows the blossoms away, then I don't get anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, you bet.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, Kurt, shall we stay on the phones, or is that it? That was it. Okay. Just want to mention a little bit more about espaliering fruit trees, and I think I've talked about this in the past, in that I think there are certain, there are good candidates for espaliering, and I think there are some less good candidates for espaliering, and I think pears and apples are the really the only two that I do. They are the only two that I do for the, because of the growing habits of them. Some people will try figs, but they're way too vigorous for me. You know, I think I have a problem with my pear pruning, my espalier pear pruning. Boy, figs would be a lot, much of the same, and you'd have to start over very often. So.
Yeah, I think one of the advantages of pears and apples is a lot of them are spur bearing, mm-hmm. so they'll bear on spurs. They don't need a big long branch to have fruit, and that makes it a lot easier to prune.
And apples are better in that respect because they have more spurs on, along the branch, right. and pears are more towards the tips.
So there
is some intricacies there. Really, once again, summer pruning on those things is great because you want to keep the plant small.
Yes.
And boy, if you pruned when they're in the winter time, then you would just encourage more growth, and that's the exact opposite of what we want for espaliered trees.
Yep.
Okay, so the time for a music break, and we'll come back with the garden stumper here. I chose this song here. Got more related this time to what we're talking about here. When we're pruning, we just want to prune a little bit. And this is called Just a Little Bit. Oh, man, I just hate to interrupt that. Mike Finnegan's arrangement of the old classic Just a Little Bit, that's from a 2000 CD called Organized, an all-star tribute to the Hammond B3 organ. Organized. Did you get that one, Jim?
I got it. Yeah, it's good, yeah.
All right, well, it's time for this stumper here, and I want to tell you a little bit about the tickets that you can win for having the correct answer to this, the question here. First of all, just to mention, a reminder here that the Hollywood Theater is in the midst of the Ecofilm Festival. The next showing will be Thursday, tomorrow, of More Than Honey. More Than Honey. I'll tell you a little bit about it here. Read some of the copy here. Oscar-nominated director Marcus Imhoff, or maybe that's Imhoof. I'm not sure, Jim. I-M-H-O-O-F. Hoof, Imhoof. I don't know. Tackles the vexing issue of why bees worldwide are facing extinction. exquisite macro photography of the bees in flight and in their hives reveals a fascinating complex world in crisis. Writes Eric Cohn in IndieWire, quote, Imhoff captures the breeding of queen bees in minute detail, ventures to a laboratory to witness a bee brain scan, and discovers the dangerous prospects of a hive facing the infection of mites. In this latter case, the camera's magnifying power renders the infection in sci-fi terms, as if we've stumbled into the discarded scene from David Cronenberg's The Fly. This is a strange and strangely moving film that raises questions of species survival in cosmic as well as apiary terms. I saw this film at the Portland International Film Festival and will be happy to see it again. And maybe this time I can have a little bit watching it from different eyes. Also following the film will be a panel discussion. And Jim, it was part of the panel discussion
two films ago.
In May, yeah. Right, The Fruit. Mm-hmm. The Fruit Hunters,
yep.
Which was great, I thought. And the audience Q&A and expert panel will be me. I'm going to be on that one there to give beekeeper's perspective, I think, from that. Also, Melissa Melko, a landscape designer and horticulturist. She is a member of Sustainable Overlook and is leading the neighborhood group's effort to become the first pesticide-free Portland neighborhood.
Wow.
So that'll be interesting to see what stumbling blocks that has. And also Dr. Dewey Caron, who is a professor of entomology and apiculture for 11 years at the University of Maryland and 29 years at the University of Delaware, affiliate professor now at OSU, has vast experience and has an updated book, Honeybee Biology and Beekeeping. He gets around in the state and the country and the world. So that should be interesting.
What time is the showing?
7 o'clock. 7:11 at 7 at the Hollywood Theater there
in
Sandy.
The Hollywood Theater is a great place to go to. And I haven't tried it yet, but next door there's a pizza place, which they apparently have something to do with. Have you tried the...
I have not.
Uh-huh. So and they can pass the pizza through the wall so you can eat in the theater.
Oh.
This is what I've been told.
Okay.
I think I'm going to try it here maybe tomorrow.
All right. We'll have the Garden Stumper right after this. Okay, I'm going to turn over duties on the Garden Stumper question to Jim, and the first caller to get this question right will get a pair of tickets to the More Than Honey showing for tomorrow.
Well, as we all know, through advertising or from hopefully our own experience, this is blueberry season. And I'm so pleased because I love blueberries and I go dancing through the blueberry bushes and pick all the really great ones. And like Duke is one of my favorite varieties. We're just sort of at the end of the Duke ripening time, which is early this year. Everything is early. And then I've just got a whole bunch of Toros, which I'm now consuming and with yogurt. In fact, this morning was a big bowl of blueberries and yogurt and a few other good things. So I thought it might be appropriate to ask this question, which is kind of fun for us Oregonians, and maybe preface this with the idea that there are a lot of really interesting native fruits in our forest, but because settlers came here, this is at least my theory, they came here in the late 1800s or mid to late 1800s, they already had a lot of fruits that they'd brought from Europe and so forth, and so they came out here, and we sort of suffered from the fact that people didn't go out to our woods and look for these totally undeveloped and somewhat unknown fruits. So, but there have been some interest in this, and I encourage it. In fact, I probably said before, anytime somebody wants to go hiking up in the Cascades, try different things. They'll taste different fruits. You can find better and worse tasting ones of the same species. So the Garden Stumper is, what blueberry relative grows taller in the shade than in the sun?
Okay. So if you have the answer to that, give us a call, 503-231-8187. We do have a caller, though. Shanti, good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hi. I wanted to know, I've never espaliered anything, and I wanted to think about espaliating an apple tree that I planted 5 years ago. Is it too late when it's that old?
What's the size of it now?
It's 6 foot.
Well, what's the main thing with the spiraling is branching, and so you imagine that you've got branches on that tree. If you've got branches that are, say, normally the first layer of an espalier is going to be somewhere around 2 feet above the ground.
Oh.
And so, and then you have usually another layer and another layer. So you top out somewhere 5 feet, maybe 6 feet high. But that's having those branches is what's going to make the espalier. So if you've got branches at those somewhere in that range, you can prune off other ones to just leave those there. Yes, you could make that into an espalier, but you have to, of course, put up some wires and some to train
some
them
to. Support. Yes,
you do have to use the wire. So if I could do that, do have branches starting pretty low because we planted it from a little baby. Mm-hmm. About 5 years ago, and he dedicated it to the life of my beautiful daughter Lotus Blossom, who passed away. And so I want it to be wonderful. And there's a fence near it. The neighbors put up a fence pretty close to it, about 2 feet away. Do I have to do something to make it relate to the fence? I mean, does the also that's the other question. Does the espalier? How do you say the word?
Espalier.
Espalier require having a fence, like within 8 inches of it, of the...
You need wires there to train the branches or to hold the branches on to at whatever angle. So oftentimes when they're sold as, ready for espaliering, they're just horizontal to the ground. But there's others you can, let your imagination run wild here. I have mine in... at 45 degrees, so when the branches cross, they form diamonds. And it was a Belgian fence.
Oh, beautiful.
Quite attractive. But you can do candelabra, have them go out horizontal, and then at the end, send them up 90 degrees, so they're going straight up.
Yeah, that's all I've ever seen. Around the neighborhood when I walk, I see people have those kinds of, candle branches, candelabra branches going...
Mm-hmm.
I think 2 feet, you was to put too far, really. You really have to have something, I would guess, within 6 to 8 inches maximum distance from the tree for the branches to train them on.
So if I have a, if I put wire, where do I put the wire? Say I cut off the, what do I do first? I cut off the upper branches and to make the lower, the branches at the 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 foot level thrive. Is that right? Is that the first step?
Yeah, you would basically build a frame, so you'd have a post on either side. Depending on your situation, but typically you have a post on either side, maybe 6 feet wide between the posts or 8 feet between the posts. And if you're going to do a horizontal espalier, then you would stretch three wires between those posts.
At maybe 2 feet. 3.5 feet, 5 feet, or whatever.
Okay.
And the best type of wire to use, the issue you're going to come, another construction issue is just that if the posts are just put in the ground, they will not, they'll pull together. So you need some bracing so that they don't.
Or in cement, so the poles don't.
Concrete around the base or something just so they don't bend in.
Okay.
And then we like using New Zealand fence wire for the wire because it doesn't stretch like regular wire does. But you probably could use regular wire. But then you want to get it fairly tight. And then you can cut the branches back and start tying the branches you want on the espalier to those wires.
And what I recommend for tying branches is, I don't even know what the name of it is anymore, but it's plastic interlocking ties. Plastic ties, they're rectangles, so you can interlock them in themselves and then undo them, anytime you need to make it larger or smaller or something like that.
It sounds a little mysterious since I've never done it. So what
and looking at pictures.
Portland nursery type of, where do I get them?
Get
from
what?
The One World catalog?
The
One Green World.
The little ties or the...
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Most nurseries will have something like that.
Yeah, or even for farm stores,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to use that. You could use twine or twisties or whatnot, but I've just found that those black rectangle interlocking ties.
Yeah.
I'd like to use what you have good experience using. So I hear you writing it all down.
To get ideas, look for pictures.
Okay.
In books or online, and then do it your own way.
Oh, I could go what to YouTube online. I've never tried that.
Yeah.
To see about the getting.
This is another idea, but there's no substitute for just doing it.
It's not difficult.
Right.
Once you get going, it'll be. It's no big mystery to the whole process.
Right. So.
Okay. And then what about the other thing is I wanted figs. I wanted to plant a fig tree and berries, and can I espalier those kinds of plants?
I wouldn't recommend espaliering. It's too vigorous. And the berries, they get trellised generally, but we don't call that espaliering because you cut those down every year and then...
Depending on the type of berry, but generally, like a blackberry, for example, you would train it to a wire. That's just what you do to grow it.
To blackberry, I would train it to a wire.
Right.
Uh-huh. Another thing I have no experience with, training something to a wire.
Well, just tying it to the wire. Because otherwise it'll go all over your garden.
Yes.
There's a lot of resources on the internet. And I would suggest you do a little, just check it out a little bit. You'll find all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
Give you some ideas.
Right. Yeah, I didn't think of that. I just think of people when I think of questions.
Well, we're proud to do that.
That's what we're here for.
That's right.
I'm happy to hear you advise me what to do because I haven't started to live where the internet is the first thing I think of.
Uh-huh. Congratulations.
Okay. That works. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling. All right, we've got some garden stumper. Dennis, good morning. You have the garden stumper answer?
Well, I think I do.
Okay.
I grew up at the coast, and the shot huckleberry is a common name for the bush. But it'll, just like you say, if it's out in full sun, it might get maybe 2 foot tall or maybe three. But if it's in partial shade, it'll get like 6 foot, 7 foot.
And you're speaking of the evergreen huckleberry, is that correct?
It is an evergreen huckleberry.
Yeah. Right. That's
ding, 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 ding. You got it. Yeah, that's really a unique characteristic of that plant.
And I did have an observation I've made in this past week on fruit trees, if you got a moment.
Sure.
I'd planted this, it's a Parson plum tree a couple of years ago, and I noticed all these aphids on the leaves. And, of course, the ants were working them, and the ladybugs were working them. And then I saw these bees lighting on the leaves, and I looked it up on the internet, and some bees actually do harvest the honeydew from the aphids. And
that's right.
What I found, amazing about that is recently, of course, that big bee die-off here in the area.
Which we'll talk about here in just a moment.
Yeah. Well, they said, oh, gee, maybe we better not spray this neonicotinoid on flowering shrubs. Well, if the bees are harvesting, honeydew off the aphids, it wouldn't matter what time of the year you were, spraying them. They'd still be...
That's right.
...have a potential to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it for me.
Okay. Thanks, Dennis. So let's be clear here. You stay on the line
will do.
And Kurt will get your name, and your name will be on the guest list at the theater. There's no tickets in exchange. You just show up at the Hollywood Theater, and your name will be on the list there. So, okay. Any questions? Are those the garden stumpers? Okay, so we do have two more pairs of tickets to give away, and we will talk about how we're going to give those away in just a bit here. So, Jim, do you want to talk about your neighbor's spray issue?
Sure, and this thing, we talked about this bee spray issue. I think, I don't want to really focus on my neighbor, but I just want to talk a little bit more about how we determine when to spray and why. I think when I was growing up, we had a backyard of fruit trees in Northeast Portland, and every spring somebody would come and spray them.
Somebody outside the family, you mean?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, some person with a machine and spray gun, and just go drench them with whatever material. I have no idea what it was. I wasn't into plants at that point, so I didn't ask. But you know, as I've grown older, I realized that there's a lot of materials out there that people sometimes just spray habitually because somebody tells them, oh, yeah, you know, you better spray. Yeah. So, oh, okay, so they get a spray and they put it on a tree or a bush or a vine or something. And why? The question really to me and the question I think people need to ask themselves is, well, why am I doing this? What pest am I trying to prevent? What is this spray? Oftentimes the actual material itself is not – the name may something like, you know, delicious fruit, you know, or more fruit or something like some great name, you know, that sounds – oh, yes, that's what I want. But when you read the fine print, you realize that you're spraying something that's pretty toxic material. And in this particular case, the spray was Malathion, which is – toxic to
this
bees.
This is your neighbor
in
here we're talking about.
Case, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I questioned and did a little research on it because of the reason for the spray was for the spotted wing Drosophila. But the actual pest had not shown itself yet.
Uh-huh.
So it was being done more as a preventive. And I understand how important a fruit crop is to a farmer. Totally understand that. I just think it's also important to be careful and to have the knowledge of that there is a pest there and that there is or mm-hmm. it's about to arrive before you spray these kinds of materials.
Well, it is a violation of the law to apply a product in a matter inconsistent with the directions, because the directions are the law. And in Wilsonville, there should be fines there because there's no doubt that they applied it when the trees were blooming.
Yeah. It's certainly not a lot of thought was given to that application, I'm sure. It was just, we have aphids, we spray this material.
Yeah, we're more afraid of aphids than bees.
Right. And the tragedies occur like this. So, yeah, it's really important to know what you're doing because and there are alternatives too. There are materials that can be used in place of these more toxic sprays. That information is not difficult to find, but it does take a little bit of research sometimes to check it out. We try personally in our business to use the least toxic material available. I think I may have mentioned on the show one time a few years ago, I was asking a local peach grower how many times they spray their peaches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 7 times, you know, with some pretty nasty material. And that was because these are varieties that get peach leaf curl. Well, we prefer growing varieties that don't get peach leaf curl,
right.
And you don't have to spray them for that.
Right. Well, I did bring in some samples here, Jim, of I don't know what variety this yellow raspberry is, so I renamed it Glenn's Honey Drop Raspberry.
Uh-huh.
And I think I have the spotted wing Drosophila showing up now mm-hmm. on these. There's just a lot of, I mean, not necessarily on those there, but
oh.
There might be some in there. But I see, you know, I was out picking this morning and I saw hundreds of fruit flies out there on these berries.
Mm-hmm.
So my rule of thumb is, well, if the berry is still firm, then I'm going to harvest it and eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, don't look at those with the microscope because there might be eggs in them.
Yeah. So, well, but you haven't seen signs of damage yet.
Well, there's some soft berries, but it's also been hot and raspberries that don't hold up very well in the heat too. So that's kind of what I attributed to. But
I wonder if any of our listeners are having problems with this.
Yeah, that's good.
We monitor our plants for that pest, and so far, besides the fact we grow a lot of berries in our mm-hmm. in our mm-hmm. various fields, we have not seen significant damage that I can identify.
Well, I should capture one of these, and so I can get it identified for sure. At least the male, as the when the wings are in the resting position, which are up,
right.
like an aircraft carrier aircraft, you know, when
right.
they fold their wings up.
Right.
And that's the male will have little spots on the wings, not the females, but that's how the name spotted wing Drosophila
mm-hmm.
gets its name. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's too bad.
Yeah, and there are if you only have a couple of bushes, like if this does become a problem for someone, then you could cover with use some of that Remay type material to cover a bush. It's a little bit of a
hassle. Well, I know that the secretary of the Home Orchard Society, or maybe she's not anymore, Sherry Spencer, has mentioned that, you know, she's had pretty good success with the vinegar traps that you can just hang out there, and they're attracted to them, and voila.
Yeah.
But I've got a lot of bushes, and so far I just harvest every day and maybe try to keep one step ahead of them and encourage spiders out there. So.
And I think it's another thing for if you can have chickens, you know, they'll scrape up all the stuff that falls on the ground.
Well, I can't. Over winter.
Yeah, if you can't, then you can't. But
yeah. All right. Well, this next song then is just directly related to that. It's called No Reason. There's just really no reason to be to spray these things there, these aliens. Yep. The Pursuit of Happiness. Pursuit of Happiness. One of my favorite groups out of the 90s. Jim, you probably never heard of them, have you? No.
Living in the country too long.
Yeah, that's 1995. Album called Where's the Bone? The Pursuit of Happiness out of Canada. Okay, we have one pair of tickets to give away to More Than Honey, and we are just going to give that to the first caller at 503-231-8187. And you'll just give your name to Kurt, and that'll be to the More Than Honey showing at the Hollywood Theater at about 41st and Northeast Sandy. All right, just briefly here of what's going on in the honeybee colony this week. It's been very interesting. Generally, our honey flow lasts until, the third week of July, where the bees are putting on actually quite a bit of weight. And I have this because I know this because I have my one colony on a stand or a scale. And towards the end of June, they were putting on 4 or 5 pounds a day. And then it went into a place where it, for whatever reason, they lost a half a pound for a couple of days in a row and stayed the same for a couple of days in a row and then lost another half a pound or a quarter of a pound. But now they've been putting on another maybe a half a pound or 3/4 of a pound. So at least they are going in the right direction. What this means is that the major nectar sources for honeybees now is over. So essentially what the honey that they've made so far is what they'll have. Now they'll put on a little bit more in the end of August and into September, but nothing that we as beekeepers would be interested in harvesting, or anything they make is goes to them. And in fact, the first 60 pounds of honey, at least they make, they keep. We don't take all the honey. In fact, there'll be many colonies that I have this year where I won't be harvesting any honey.
So if you had summer blooming plants, would you then, could you reverse that trend a little bit?
Or? Yes, the more the merrier. Mm-hmm. But
the orchard of jujube, I'd recommend.
Yeah, that would be the thing to do. Is, you know, is you know, I'd like to, my fantasy here, Jim, is to have a trailer where I could just pull a half a dozen or a dozen colonies following the bloom, you know, in the city, or, you know, in the country, not running up to catch the fireweed in the Mount Hood, or
right. Well, that would be fun.
So are they? So jujubes?
Yeah, jujubes bloom in the midsummer. Yeah,
and
very bees love them. I mean,
see, that could be because there's just nothing else.
Could be.
I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, if a jujube was blooming in May, they may not get any bees.
Yeah.
I mean, just because I don't know, but
I don't either.
Their blossom may not be as attractive.
The bees, you know, if I could talk to the bees, I could probably find out. But they seem to be happy with those flowers.
You know, that's just more than honey. Maybe they'll.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Well, they do a brain scan.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to mention something. I just remember how inspired I was yesterday because I was actually harvesting seaberry fruit.
Yes.
About 3 to 4 weeks earlier. And this is two varieties, Russian varieties that I have, that the birds were starting to eat. I couldn't believe it. I was like, I said, birds, I want to take pictures of these. I want to harvest them. So I went out and I got lots and lots of berries off two different plants. Was really pleased with that. They're really interesting. I mean, that's just so early, you know.
Yes. Well, that is right in line with what the honey weight is on the that scale there, that, you know, maybe the main honey flow is over.
Yeah.
Which means we can start harvesting honey now then.
Oh
actually, I already have started harvesting some honey, but it's a major harvest then.
I would love to get some.
Huh, yeah.
We eat a lot of honey and our tea in the morning, and the price keeps going up.
Nothing wrong with that, Jim.
For beekeepers. Yeah, well, we need to honor the bees. They're certainly doing a good job for us.
Well, I was thinking that, you know, I won't mention names here, but I was talking to a representative from the Xerces Society to see if he might be interested in being part of the panel for this, and he was a little put off by the quote attributed to Einstein. You know, said, you know, if the bees leave, then, you know, as humans, we only have 4 years or of, you know, whatever. You know, if there's no bees, then humans will only have 4 years to live or something like that. And I was just thinking about that. And, well, first of all, if Einstein said it, and there's no, we don't know that he said that. There's no proof that he said that. It's just attributed to him. And it really does him a disservice because he didn't, if he did say it, and I can't believe that he didn't think it through at all. I mean, did he mean honeybees or did he mean all bees? I mean, there's 20,000 species of bees. I mean, he could say the same thing about bacteria. If we didn't have bacteria, we'd be dead in 1 month or a year or something, maybe. And here I am on my, I get a soapbox here, you know.
Yeah, sure.
But the honeybees are not native to North America. You know, did he say that when he was in Germany? Or did he say that when he was in the United States?
Right.
Or when in Europe? I'm not sure if he was from Germany. Maybe it was Austria. You remember? Well, in any event, the way the world works, even if, you know, for whatever strange reason that if bees did leave, what is the insect that's most responsible for pollination in the world? I think it's beetles.
Hmm.
And flies are up there too. So even if there weren't any bees, I think that something would evolve to take their place. It's just how niches work and nature works, and it's... Let's don't mess with it.
That's right. Let's not mess with it. That's the best way to end this show. Don't mess with nature.
Okay. Well, I hope to see many of you tomorrow at the More Than Honey show. Jim, I'm sure glad that you were able to fight through the traffic.
I am too. I'm really happy to be here, Glenn.
And here's the main thing here. We will be here live next month. We don't need to record the show because I'll be back on Tuesday the 13th, and our next show is the 14th. So,
are you going to bring some of
the Swedish pancakes?
Swedish pancakes with you?
No.
No. Darn.
But bring figs, Jim.
Okay. All right.
Thanks for listening. Be well. We'll be back next month.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd Avenue, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 12:01. Coming up next, Jazz Lives with your host, Nick Geffro.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for July 10th, 2013.
Given all the turmoil in Egypt, there's some risk the country may be facing civil war. Security in the area has deteriorated dramatically since the overthrow of President Mubarak in 2011. It is possible war could occur pitting the Islamic